So we've been going through a red letter study, and we're back on the red letter study, and it's been great. We're making our way through the Sermon on the Mount. We just finished chapter 6 of Matthew last week. We're going to be moving into chapter 7 this morning. But last week, we got into something that I think was really interesting but also instructive. We were talking about a quote from Thomas Merton. Actually, it was a little piece of his last address to his community, the Abbey at Gethsemane in Kentucky, back in 1965, before he went into the Hermitage. There he spent the last 3 years of his life. And he was talking about the fact that the world is transparent. The world is transparent, and God is always shining through. God is everywhere. God is in everyone and in everything and through, and always shining through. And we can't get away from God. There is no possible way that we could go someplace where God isn't. God is everywhere and always shining through this transparent world. So why doesn't it appear that way to us? Why don't we see that? Why is it we can go through so much of our day and so many of the details of our day as if the world were completely opaque, as if nothing were shining through? And he talks about that, and he says it's because when we focus on one thing, in its isolation, as if it were a package coming to us in opaque wrapping paper, right? And we're busy unwrapping it, and we're getting down layer by layer, and when we get down to the bottom, there's nothing there. Because what we've been unwrapping is just our thought, our belief, our impression of something, and not the thing itself. And then when we get down to the bottom and there's nothing there, then we grab another one and we start unwrapping that one, and then another one after that, and another one after that. And we keep ourselves occupied in the unwrapping, in the analyzing of each object that we see, object by object. But really all we're doing is analyzing our own thoughts, our own beliefs about that object. He said, if you could just let a rabbit show its rabbitness, the way he put it, just let it show its rabbitness, you know, and God will shine through the rabbit. If you just take away everything else, get lost in the experience of that rabbit that's jumping around on your lawn or wherever, and everything changes. I think what he's describing is everything about our lives, about the way we live our lives, why the spiritual world seems so remote to us, so invisible to us, because we are busy analyzing every little thing. A friend of mine sent me an email just a few days ago reminding me of another quote from Thomas Merton, this time from his book, Ascent to Truth. And I want to read it to you, and it's in your handouts if you want to read along with me, because I think it takes it even a step further. And this is what he's saying here. The earthly desires men cherish are shadows. There is no true happiness in fulfilling them. Why then do we continue to pursue joys without substance? Because the pursuit itself has become our only substitute for joy. Unable to rest in anything that we achieve, we determine to forget our discontent in a ceaseless quest for new satisfactions. In this pursuit, desire itself becomes our chief satisfaction. Did you hear that? Desire itself becomes our chief satisfaction. The goods that so disappoint us when they are in our grasp can still stimulate our interest when they elude us in the past or in the future. When they elude us in the present or in the past. I was riffing on that one. Do you see what he's saying here? I think this is so important for us to get. How many of us have spent so much of our time planning for something in the future, praying for that outcome, working so hard for that to pass? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. When it doesn't, we're understandably disappointed, right? But when it does, what happens? It's exciting for one dinner, one night. And then we're right back to getting another package to unwrap, another thing to point us in the future. My friend followed that quote up with this one by Blaise Pascal. Blaise Pascal is a really interesting character. He's a 17th century French mathematician of all things, but also a philosopher. He was a devout Catholic, so he was a religious writer and philosopher. He was an inventor, you know? He was all about chance and random numbers and mathematics. So he invented the first calculator, for one thing. Pretty cool. But he also invented the roulette wheel. So there, you get that one for free. He also came up with Pascal's wager, which some of you may have heard, which is a way of looking at the existence of God. But we're not going to get into that. Take a look at what he says there and link it to what Merton just said. He said, a man can pass his life away without boredom merely by gambling each day with a modest sum. Give him each morning the amount that each might actually win, all right, on the condition that he cannot gamble, and you will make him miserable. Did you get that? Now, if he gambles every day, right, he will never be bored, and he will always be interested in the gambling. But if you just give him the money that he might have won, he's going to end up being miserable. Very well. If you think that it is the amusement of gaming that he seeks, let him play for nothing, and he'll be bored to death. He wants to get worked up and delude himself that he would be happy if he could win the amount of money that he would refuse on the condition that he could not gamble. A man does not spend a day hunting a fox in order to kill it. That's not the point. Do you get what he's saying here and how it relates? We're all about the hunt. We're all about the pursuit. We're all about the thing that is eluding us, because that's what gives us that promise of fulfillment. But as soon as we have it, then it doesn't fulfill anymore, and we're bored. And we're looking for the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing. We can look to the future for that promised fulfillment. We can even look to the past. What do you think reincarnation is all about? Everybody who believes in reincarnation, you know, they were a warrior princess or some king or some fabulous figure. They're never the guy who's just cleaning up camel dung around the pyramid. We imagine wonderful pasts and wonderful futures because the present is not fulfilling to us. And it's not fulfilling to us because it is opaque, because God is not shining through for us, because we're still unwrapping all of these packages, which is just unwrapping our thoughts over and over and over again. And this is exactly what Jesus is talking about. When we're focused on the chase, when we cannot just rest in the moment, let the moment be enough for us to understand what that moment really is when God's presence is shining through, then we're always going to be focused on the past or the future and never, ever here now. Which means we will never be in presence and we will never be in kingdom, because kingdom is here, kingdom is now, and only here and now. How many times have we said you're only going to find God at the corner of here and now? If you're not there, you are not going to experience God's presence. If we are still in the pursuit, then the world is opaque and we are living in fear and we are living in worry, tons of worry. Because we're always worried about that thing out there that we're chasing. And it's exactly like chasing the horizon or chasing the end of the rainbow. We will never, ever catch up to it. This is what Jesus is also talking about. When he closed up chapter 6, what we just finished, what was it? The whole theme of those last passages? Do not worry. And he gave us all those examples. You know, the birds aren't worrying. The flowers aren't worrying. You know, why are you worrying? And then he opens up chapter 7, and he's going to tell us, do not judge. And it seems to us like it's a new topic, like we're changing topics because, hey, we went from chapter 6 to chapter 7. That must be a new topic, right? Well, did you know that chapter headings were not inserted into the scriptures until the 14th century? 14th century was the first time the chapter headings got put in. Up until that time, the entire text of the Bible had no chapter headings. It had no verse markings, right? It had no subheadings or anything like that the editors have added. It also had no parsing. Words were not parsed. There were no spaces between words. There were all consonants in the Greek. In the Hebrew, it's all consonants. I'm sorry. It's all capitals in the Greek. And in the Hebrew, it's all consonants. There are not even any vowel points. And the whole thing was completely, fully justified. So it was even lines. So that meant that when you got to the end of the line and you ran out of the number of characters you could have for that line, even if it was in the middle of the word started on the next line. Now, I want you to think about the experience of reading the scriptures in those ancient manuscripts like that. Just columns of text with nothing, not even any spacing between the words. The text just flowed through. Meaning just flowed through. And when the chapter headings and the verse headings and all that were put in, the verse numbers, they did the best they could, but they didn't always make breaks where they logically should be in terms of what the verse is talking about. And this is one of those cases. There's a continuation of thought here that's happening between what Jesus is talking about at the end of chapter 6 and what he's going to talk about here at the beginning of chapter 7. He's talking about don't worry. He says, seek first the kingdom, which is seek first this present moment. Seek first God's connection in this moment. Seek that first and everything else is going to be added. And then he moves right immediately. Do not judge. There is a continuation here. They are all talking about the same thing. They're all going to be making the same point because fear causes both of these symptoms in us. It causes worry, which is just literally taking thought, is the word that is there in the Greek and the Aramaic. Taking thought, continuing to take thought, continuing to spin it around. Fear causes both worry and also this judgment that we're always doing. And all of that makes kingdom opaque. So let's take a look at what he says right at the beginning of chapter 7, verse 1 and 2. He says, do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way that you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. All right. So what does that mean to us? Now, when we take those two verses and we separate them from all the context of what happened before in chapter 6, from the worry and for the seeking kingdom passages, doesn't it sound punitive? Right? If we do wrong, that is, if we judge someone, and that's wrong, then someone, or God, is going to wrong us back. Isn't that really the sense that we get from just reading the English in isolation that way? And we interpret it this way because we're looking at it all with Western eyes. Take a look at the chart here, and if you can put it up there, Alex. So it's going to be on the screens, but it's also in your handouts. There is such a difference between Eastern and Western thought. There's such a difference between Hebrew thought and Greek thought. And if you don't understand the difference between these two, the scriptures are always going to elude us because they're coming from such a different place. So for us to really understand how Jesus is understanding judgment as he's using it here, let's take a look. Because both East and West have a worldview. And you can best describe the worldview of the West, of Greek thought, as dualism. And make no mistake, we, as modern Westerners, we are children of Greek philosophy and Roman law. That is our heritage. That's what has funneled down to us. And that's what was overlaid on the Jewish Eastern scriptures by the second century. And so they have been interpreted through that lens for 1,800 years. And that's the heritage that we have. But we're trying to end run that and get back to the beginning, understand what would Jesus have meant by this. And so dualism is the idea that the world is made up of separate and opposing forces. They're mutually exclusive, and they're in conflict with one another. Good and evil would be a perfect example. Light and dark would be another. Male and female, Republican and Democrat, whatever you want to hold up as diametrically opposed opposites that are in conflict with one another. So dualism is characterized by separation and opposition. But if you look over on the Hebrew side, on the Eastern side, oneness, the connectedness of all things, the image of the snake eating its tail, that circle, that oneness is the basis of their worldview. So it's all about unity. It's all about connection. It's one thing. When we look at all the individual form and function that we see around us in the world, the Eastern mind understands that there is oneness at the core of all of that. Its basic nature is not separated or dualistic. It's unified. It's one thing. And then when you move down a category here, we're talking about what is the organizing principle that we use to organize our societies, organize our groups, organize our whatever it is that we're doing. And in the West, it's going to be legalism. It's going to be about the law, starting with Roman law here in the West. And so the behavior that is expected from the people is going to be conformance. It's going to be obedience. And for the most part, it means passive obedience. You don't question the authority, you just obey it. And you conform to it. But the organizing principle in the East would be relationship, transformance and active participation. Now, it is true that by Jesus' time, the Pharisees had moved into a legalistic attitude, and that's why Jesus was fighting so hard against it. It wasn't the idea of the law when it was first given. The word Torah itself just means instruction and guidance. It's a funnel by which we can move through to get to the experience of this now presence of God, the experience of this relationship that we have, this oneness that we have with each other. But it had devolved, and that's why Jesus was in such opposition with them. And what does that relate to in terms of the focus that we will have as a people that are coming from this worldview to this organizing principle? Well, for here, those of us in the West, the focus is going to be there then. The focus is going to be on the past. The focus is going to be on the future. But in the East, the focus is here now, this present moment. As children of Greek philosophy and Roman law, we have this worldview, we have this organizing principle and this focus of dualism. And when we consider what Jesus is talking about here in terms of judgment, if we look at this dualistically, then the action, the judging, is going to be separate from the reaction. It's going to be separate from the consequence in time of action and reaction. Action and consequence. The judging and the will be judged are separate in time because they're dualistic. Things are separate in time. We're going to look at it legally. This unlawful action, judging, is going to necessitate some kind of correction or punishment. And so we're looking at it that way. And we're always looking at it in terms of there then. The correction and the punishment will come in the future, not here and now, but sometime in the future. That means we're going to be always fearing the future for our past offenses. Healthy way to live, huh? Now, in the East, the Hebrew concepts are always pointing in the opposite direction. So that worldview is going to be oneness. So the action now and the reaction or the consequence are actually one and the same. There is no distinction between them. The relationship part of it, that organizing principle, the action isn't wrong because it's unlawful, not because Jesus said, do not judge, but because it breaks relationship. That's why it's wrong. That's why the Pharisees were so off base in making the law and following the law perfectly the mark of God's approval in their lives. Didn't have anything to do with being unlawful. It had to do with what was breaking relationship. And that's what Jesus was trying to reintroduce to the people. And the focus here now, the action and the reaction are simultaneous. They're one and the same, but they're also simultaneous. We're not talking about some third-party punishment here coming down on us, judging us in the same way that we judge, tit for tat, just because we did this, someone's going to do it for us. It's all about what happens in the experience of the moment itself. What is happening in that moment? Because when we act in presence, when we act in non-judgment, which means when we lose ourselves completely in the moment, we are experiencing it in real time. The connection that we feel there is the reward. And it's the only reward. When we do things that we see as righteous, when we do things that we see as lawful, somehow we think that we're getting brownie points with God, that he's marking something on a big board or he's got a clipboard or something up there, and we're going to get those benefits when we get up to the pearly gates. What this worldview is telling us is that the connection that we feel right here and now is that reward. And there is nothing else coming. Because the next moment, we have the choice to make again. Are we going to move into that moment? Are we going to connect in that moment? And even when we die, what is eternity? But one moment, eternally. What is our choice there? Are we going to choose the connection that will give us that reward? When he was talking about the Pharisees, you know, when they stand up in front of you and pray and let everyone know how great they are or make a big deal about how much money they've given, he says they have the reward in full. There is nothing else coming. There is no connection to be had because they are separating themselves off. Did you know that the word Pharisee in Hebrew means separated one? That's the way they saw themselves. They made a virtue out of separating themselves from everything that they saw is unclean. And Jesus says, then you have your reward in full. There is nothing else coming. But when we act in this non-judgmental way, when we act in a way where we're just lost in the moment, lost in the connection with each other, then everything changes. That's how we can start to see what Jesus is talking about here. This presence, this acting. So how do we want to understand Jesus? How can we understand what he's talking about when he talks about judging? What you believe is your reality. We've talked about this a few weeks in a row now. We all have our thought worlds. Our thoughts are what create reality for us. We don't experience reality directly. We experience it through the filter of our beliefs. And those beliefs, some of them unconscious, some of them implanted in us when we were children, are still down there working on us, driving the bus. Those beliefs order and shape the experience of our life. Truly, the reality that we believe is the reality that we endure. It's all about that thought world. Creating our reality. So we're all going to see reality through the filter of what we believe, both positive and negative. How often does Jesus say, your faith has made you whole? Your faith has healed you. Your faith has saved you. Faith, belief, trust, all those three concepts are always contained in the word faith. Where you see it in the New Testament or you see belief in the New Testament, add the other two because they're all part of the package. What you believe, what you act on, what you trust is the reality. And if you have that kind of faith in your healing, that's what is going to heal you. That's what's going to save you. It's what you believe, what you trust, what you are moving on. The belief that we have adopted, the belief that we have imposed on us, that standard defines our reality, whether it's positive or whether it's negative. It's the reality that we endure. So, before it is ever applied to others, what we believe in terms of judgment, it is already applied to ourselves. Do you see how that works? We live in a world of our own making. Before we ever try to impose it on someone else. That's why Jesus is so adamant about this. Watch how you judge each other. Watch the standards that you are holding others to, because you've already been held to that standard. And if that standard is based in fear, if that standard is based in an opaque world, if that standard is based in having your treasures and your heart here on earth rather than in the presence of God, then the world is opaque to you. The transparency of God cannot shine through. This is what he's talking about when he talks about judgment. It's not just about condemning each other. That's just one dimensional. He's talking about how the very process of having these standards that we are adhering to and relying on so much that we can't even see what is right in front of us. We can't see the person that is right in front of us. We can't love that person because they don't conform to what we need in our lives at this moment because of the fear that we have. Jesus is telling us not to judge, because as long as we are engaged in that kind of behavior, the kingdom is off limits to us. Not because God is keeping us out, but because the world is opaque and we can't even see the possibility of the kind of unity and connection that kingdom is. So God doesn't do any judging later on us in retribution. We're doing it to ourselves right here, right now. If you want to look at it this way, judging is a result of an imperfect view of perfect love. If that helps you, stick it on the fridge. If we see love as legal, right? If we see love as not perfect, if we see love as having to be earned through any performance, then everyone is not loved the same in our worldview. Love now has degrees depending on how well we perform. And we're judging people based on that, how well they perform. And love is no longer perfect. This is so important to understand. Because we are living under that same system. That's why we're always worried. That's why we're always wondering if we are good enough, if we have done enough to earn God's approval, when it has nothing to do that with that. We are judging different degrees of love, and we're living under that judgment. Now you might be asking, but don't we have to judge? I mean, just going through life day by day, don't we have to make judgments about people and situations? Don't we have to figure things out so that we don't fall into the same mistakes over and over again or put ourselves in really dangerous positions? Well, of course. We need to know who we can trust, right? We need to know how to choose between alternatives, of course. But we need to make a distinction now between judgment and discernment. There's a difference between the two. When you judge something, you are forming an opinion about it. You're forming a conclusion about it based on a standard that you already have preset in your mind. You have a standard, and you're judging it against that standard. That's judgment. Now, we can do that from across the parking lot. We can do that from a distance. We already have an idea of what this type of person is, or that type of person, or this type of situation, or this group, or whatever. We have all those things loaded into the database. And so we see that thing coming, and we automatically are off to the races, and we have our judgment done. That's the problem. The judgment keeps us separate. It reinforces the separation that we already believe in our hearts, right? Now, what is discernment? Discernment is an opinion or a conclusion that we reach based on experience. Very, very different. It's a perception. It's to perceive or to recognize truth based on having experienced that truth firsthand. We need to discern. We have to discern to be responsible people. We need to recognize truth experientially. But this means that there is no internal standard that we're judging by. We're not comparing a person or a situation to that standard. We're just seeing reality as it is. And what this does is implies that we have spent some time together. How in the world do we get the experience of one another if we haven't spent the time? We have to spend the time, which means that we have a connection, which means that we gave this person or this situation or this group every benefit of every doubt before we finally came to the conclusion that we've come to. I want to read you a story about judgment. And this comes from Mr. Rogers. Actually, it doesn't come from Mr. Rogers. It's about Mr. Rogers. And I have read this before, so if you've heard it before, please just suffer in silence and no spoilers here. It's a great story. I've only heard Fred Rogers describe himself as judgmental once. It wasn't a word typically associated with him. In fact, his character was more likely to be depicted by judgmental's antonyms: merciful, accepting, tolerant. But at least one time, he felt the word fit, and its sting changed his life. He was in seminary at the time. As part of his studies and to encourage the development of his homiletic skills, He would visit different churches to see how the various ministers preached. Well, in New England one weekend, he and some friends decided to visit the church of a well-known and well-respected pulpiter. But after the service began, they discovered the presiding minister was away, and a supply preacher, a rather aged one at that, would be speaking in his place. That, of course, was a disappointment. But Fred had heard good supplies before, as well as suffered through the sermon. As well as meaningful messages from older preachers. Unfortunately, this man was neither good nor meaningful. Fred suffered through the sermon, mentally checking off every homiletic rule the man was bending, breaking, or completely disregarding. The sermon went against everything Fred was learning in seminary. When it ended, mercifully, he told me later, he turned to the friend beside him to commiserate. But before he could say anything, the tears he saw streaming down her face muted his words. "He said exactly what I needed to hear," she whispered to him. That bungle of a sermon was what he needed to hear. Fred didn't know what to say. But as he began to ponder the gulf between their reactions, he realized that the essential difference lay within. She had come in need, and he had come in judgment. And because of her need and the sincerity of the old preacher, the Holy Spirit was able to translate the words, poorly constructed as they were, into exactly what she needed to hear. That experience shaped the rest of Fred's life. And it changed his TV neighborhood as well. He not only committed to reserving judgment, but he also opened himself up to the mystery of the holy ground. I'm so convinced that the space between the television set and the viewer is holy ground, he told me on the set of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in 1994. And what we put on the television can, by the Holy Spirit, be translated into what this person needs to hear and see. And without that translation, it's all dross, as far as I'm concerned. I love this story, especially because it's Fred Rogers, right? If he can be judgmental, then I can forgive myself. He judged this sermon. He judged this preacher based on his own internal standard, what he wanted to see, what he had been learning in school, what he expected from the preacher that he wanted to hear. From all the learned principles that he had gathered up to that point, and all the emotional triggers that were happening at the same time. Then later, he discerned that the standards that he had don't define the effectiveness of anything, or the connection, or the action of spirit that is available to every single one of us. You see, discernment doesn't separate us. It doesn't objectify people, situations, the world at large. We can discern someone maybe untrustworthy, right? But without condescension. We can still maintain a relationship with that person. It's not the opinion, it's not the prejudice or the bias that we're reacting to. It's just an experienced fact. Right? Let's say you have an old wristwatch that you just love. Maybe it was given to you by someone that was meaningful to you, and so this thing has sentimental value, but it always runs slow. Are you going to just junk that thing? Or are you going to make arrangements and workarounds to be able to realize, okay, it always runs this slow, I can deal with that. Or maybe I wind it more. Maybe I know that I need to adjust the time. But you can still have a relationship with that watch. You can still love that watch. Even though you've discerned that it's untrustworthy when it comes to its basic function in life, right? I had a friend, and I've probably told this story to you before, so again, suffer in silence. But this was decades ago. His name was Ram. He came from India, and he was the most gracious man that I think I've ever met in many ways. He just was this lovely guy. He was an IT specialist, which you wouldn't think of putting grace and IT specialist together, but that worked for him. He had very dark skin and brilliant teeth. So when he smiled, it was like turning on a light in the room. He just literally lit up the room. And we became friends at work, and so we started hanging out after work and trying to do things together. But he had this one characteristic, and I think it maybe came from, you know, coming from India, where they have a different concept of time, maybe, because Ram was always late. And not just 10 or 15 minutes. He could be an hour or two late, and it didn't seem to faze him in the least. You know, and it would aggravate me because, of course, you know, you're waiting and waiting and waiting for this guy. But I enjoyed his company. And even after he showed up, yeah, I was aggravated. He showed up. But after a few minutes, it was just Ram and we were just having a good time. So rather than junk Ram and judge him as unable to have a relationship with, I decided that every time we got together, it would be at my house. He would just come to my house. That way, I just kept living my life until Ram showed up, and then it was all great. It was all great, you know? And usually he showed up with tandoori chicken. And usually the red was all over his shoes as well. The sauce was, it was just, oh. When we discern rather than judge, we can maintain relationship. The connection of discernment means that we have spent time with a person. We not have found other attributes that are attractive to us, that we love, and we can work around the things that need to be worked around. Judgment disallows all of that. There is no way to do that in judgment, because across the parking lot, before they've even gotten close to you, you've already rendered your judgment, and there is no coming back from that. Judgment separates us from each other, and most importantly, it separates us from the moment itself. That contains each other, that contains God's presence. When we are separate from the moment, when we are still in the hunt, in the pursuit, in the future, in the past, we cannot connect with everything that is right here and right now, which is everything that there is. The only moment that exists is this moment. So we can discern, but we don't want to judge. Then, if we do, we will be living in fear. We will be living in worry. We'll be living in the past and the future, always on the chase, never now, never kingdom. If you analyze what Jesus is really doing, he's doing some CBT with us, cognitive behavioral therapy. And if you don't know what that is, you know, CBT is a type of therapy that's dealing with the symptoms of our mental issues, our emotional issues that we're dealing with. It's going to look at the symptoms and work on those. And it's going to work on those first by making us aware of the thought patterns, of the behavioral patterns that are existing. Those are the symptoms of whatever beliefs or whatever mental, if you want to call them defects or, you know, divergent issues that we have. It's going to manifest in our thought patterns, our behavior patterns, and our emotions. And so CBT is going to look at those symptoms and start dealing with those, make us aware of them, make us aware how they affect our feelings, affect our actions, and then give us some remedies, give us some ways of starting to change those ingrained patterns of thought and behavior. So then backward, it starts to work on the source. The actual source of the problem. This is what Jesus is really doing with us, if you think about it. What is worry and what is judgment? Watch those things. Watch those thought and behavior patterns. Because worry and judgment are symptoms of our deeper, even unconscious beliefs and fears. But as we become more aware of them, as we start to realize, if you're trying not to judge, how do you judge? How are you applying that? If you're trying not to worry, what is it that worries you? What is it that offends you? And you're looking at those things more and more. You're becoming more and more aware. Because until you have awareness, you can't change anything. Awareness is always the first step. This is what Jesus is trying to do for us and through us by his teaching. By becoming more aware of our thoughts and our emotions and our behavior, the first thing that we can do is do no harm. It's kind of a spiritual Hippocratic oath, you know? You become aware that you've got this thing going on, this thought going on, you know? Like Jesus said, you think you're okay because you haven't killed someone, you haven't murdered someone, but I'm telling you, even if you have a negative thought in your head, you're already guilty. He's saying, watch those thoughts. because they are indicators of what is deeper in you. And as you become more and more aware of that, you can stop yourself before you act on them. You can maintain relationships. You can do no harm with each other. But then deeper, you're beginning the dismantling of those source beliefs and fears that are fueling all of this. It all starts with awareness. It can't change what we're not aware of. And then Jesus talks about this. Make sure that your treasures are not here on earth in temporary things, but put them in heaven. And heaven is the euphemism for God, right? So it's God's presence. Because where your treasure is, your heart is. Where is your heart? We can ask ourselves these questions as we are developing our awareness. Where is our heart? Where is our treasure? How clear is our worldview? He said the eye is the lamp of the body. If the eye is clear, the body is full of light. How clear is our worldview? It's not just our physical eye. It's the way that we think. How clear is that? How much is it letting us actually see what's right in front of us? And how much are we just looking at the inside of our eyelids, those filters that are ordering our life, even without our permission? How much do we worry? How much do we judge? How much are we offended by? Are we ever, ever content in just a quiet moment? Or does a quiet moment make us crazy? And we have to add the next thing and the thing after that and start chasing again. Because the moment terrifies us. Because we finally have to face who we are apart from all of these packages we're unwrapping. Can we just be? Can we just sit? Can we just hear God's voice without words? Are we always on the hunt? Are we always on the chase? Are we always gambling with something just to try to gin up the feeling that there is some kind of fulfillment, there's some kind of meaning in life? Are we always looking at the past? Are we always looking at the future? Jesus is giving us the roadmap for more and more awareness about what is really at issue. Because what we believe is what we endure. And what we believe is how we judge and how everything is going to appear to us as we experience moment by moment. First thing Jesus said in Mark when he comes into his public ministry, Mark 1:15, is the waiting is over. The kingdom is here. If we're waiting for something, we're not in kingdom. If we're waiting for something, the world is opaque. But as soon as we can rest in what is right here and right now, the world becomes transparent and God can actually shine through. And the oneness of everyone and everything that is the basic reality of life, as Jesus is showing us, can actually become apparent. And it changes everything. That's where he's trying to get us to go. It starts with awareness. Start looking at yourself in your moments and see what you find and see how we can break through to the oneness that Jesus is offering. Let's pray. Father, we know that you're here right now. This room is filled with you, filled with your presence. It's as if we're swimming in the water of your presence. We can't get away from it. It invades every nook and cranny. And yet we can remain unaware. That's the part we want to change with your help, Lord. Help us to take the steps that we need to take. Help us to spend the time that we need to spend. Most importantly, help us to see the value in silence and solitude and stillness and simplicity that will give us the motivation to take these first steps and to continue them, especially when you still seem so far away, knowing that you're not. And knowing that each moment gives us another choice to be able to just fall into your grace. So, Father, thank you for everything that you've given us. Help us to move into that grace and never let us forget that we can only love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.